Real quick kind of housekeeping thing concerning the class. This class is going to last through March and April and May and June. That's a little bit longer than normal, but here's the reason why. We're getting started late. The quarter actually began the first Sunday in March, which would be the 5th, but we weren't prepared to do this. So we're getting started late. I'm going to be gone one Sunday in May. I'm going to be gone one Sunday in June. And what that works out to is that this will be 13 class periods, and we'll have the whole opportunity to go through the book of Revelation together if we take till June to get that done. All righty. How many of you have not, I mean, this is a true confession time, how many of you have not ever read the entire book of Revelation? Okay, we've got a couple who have not done that. How many of you really haven't, but you didn't want to admit that right here? No, never mind. Never mind. The book of Revelation is confusing and a little bit scary to people. Many people assume that it's the most difficult book in the New Testament, and it is not. Not by a wide margin, it is not the most difficult book in the New Testament. My vote for that goes to Hebrews. And the reason for that is that the book of Hebrews requires you to have an extensive knowledge of the Old Testament before you can ever successfully work into the book of Hebrews. Revelation is just different. There's a big surprise. You didn't know that. But today, here's the first new fact you get. It's different. And we're going to talk about the difference that it demonstrates. If you want to just tweak me, you know, say Revelations with an S on the end of it. That'll just grate on my nerves, because there is just the one book of Revelation. But you hear people frequently talk about Revelations 21. Say, stop it. Okay, so there's just the one Revelation. And we're going to deal with that. It gets its name from the very first word of the book. Sometimes it's called the apocalypse. Apocalypsis is the Greek word that means a revealing, a revelation. And that is an interesting clue from the beginning, because it's not supposed to be a puzzle. It's supposed to be very quickly and obviously revealing. You're supposed to read this and quickly, easily get the sense of what God is revealing to us. You hear all kinds of nonsense and silliness about Revelation, and especially with the TV preachers and the other things that go on. And I'm one of the things that I absolutely, positively want to do in this class is give you the sense that, number one, the book is not that tough. And number two, when we finish this class, you will be absolutely confident that you understand it. You understand Revelation, and it is not going to scare you any longer. It will frustrate you, because you will understand it, and you'll hear a lot of nuttiness from other people that just can't possibly be right. But I'm confident that you're going to understand it. Okay, here's some things we want to keep in mind, and I've already touched on a couple of these. Number one, the book is not that tough to understand. It just really isn't. The literature is different from the kind of literature that we're used to reading, and that shouldn't bother us at all, except that we've never really had to deal with this kind of literature before. We never read poetry in the same way that you would read a personal letter. They have different rules. And so you apply the rules of poetry to poetry, and you apply the rules of a personal letter to a personal letter. You don't get upset in a poem when there is not a salutation and a closing greeting. You don't think that something's missing somehow. Of course not. It's a poetry. You know, it goes by its own set of rules. So what we want to do is make sure that we understand the rules for dealing with apocalyptic literature. This is a special kind of literature. This is not the only example of it. There are lots of other examples of it. And we're going to talk about some of those rules and how they apply. Second thing that we need to keep in mind as we get started is the book was not written to a bunch of people who had nothing but time on their hands and could sit around working out puzzles. How many of you do the newspaper puzzles, the crosswords, the... What's this new in the math puzzle? What's that called? I don't know how to pronounce it. Sudoku or something like that. It's kind of interesting puzzle. Okay. You can only do that because you got a little free time. That's the only way you can get those puzzles done, because you got a little free time. These people did not have a little free time, and they were not allowed to sit around and speculate about, well, this means this and this means that, and try to work out all the symbolism here. They were supposed to get it instantly. And we'll talk about some more reasons for that. When I say it was meant to be understood instantly and emotionally, you have to realize that this is supposed to have big impact. There is a purpose for this book, and it actually does have a purpose, and it's an emotional purpose, too. Number three, the book is written in symbolic language. Big surprise there. It has some really startling figures and images that describe real entities. Now, the thing about this is you don't want to try to press every detail, and this is where a lot of people go wrong when they approach Revelation. They want to press every detail into a mold so that this means this, and this means this, and this means this, and this means... And typically, they try to give it a modern construction. I mean, when you hear these guys on TV and some other people that have approached this, they'll say things like, these scorpions over here, well, those are helicopter gunships. And I'm not sure how you're going to get that, and I don't really think that the early Christians would have been impressed with that kind of an understanding of the book. You know, it really wouldn't have a lot to say to them, since they'd never seen helicopter gunships before. So there's a lot of nuttiness that goes on. We don't want to get trapped into trying to make every detail match some spiritual reality or some modern reality. Some of these things are thrown in there just for splendor. Just to make the vision more dramatic and vivid. And that shouldn't upset anybody either. That's just the way the literature works. And we're gonna talk about how the literature works. But because the book is written in symbolic language, we automatically understand that most things in the book will be figurative unless we have really good reasons for taking them literally. Okay? So this is figurative language. These are visions that John has, and he's describing what he sees, and what he sees is a representation of what God is trying to communicate to us, what he is communicating to us. Our responsibility is to understand the vision as John sees it and records it for us. So it's figurative, it's symbolic. And it is really important for us to remember that our primary approach, when you first look at this, most of this is going to be symbolic and figurative. All right? It's not mostly going to be literal. Okay, number four. The fourth thing that we want to keep in mind as we approach this is that the events in the book are things that are going to take place soon. So it has immediate relevance for the earliest Christians who got it. This isn't primarily a locked mystery that can only be understood at the far tail end of human history. The disciples who got the message first got a message that was for them. Let's look at these passages. Go with me to Revelation chapter 1. And it's fascinating to me that chapter 1 and chapter 22 lay heavy stress on the idea that it's coming to pass soon. You know, this is coming along very, very quickly. Okay? First of all, we go to Revelation chapter 1 and verse 1. That's a good place to start. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who testifies to everything he saw, that is, the word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. Blessed is the one who reads the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear it and take to heart what is written in it, because the time is near. Okay? He's kind of repeated that idea right there in the first three verses. The time is short, it will soon take place, the time is near. So there's some immediate relevance here for the earliest Christians. excuse me, you go over to, chapter 3 and verse 11. In the letter to the church at Philadelphia, again, Jesus says, I am coming soon. Hold on to what you have so that no one will take your crown. I'm coming soon. So these things are going to happen rather rapidly. Skip on over to chapter 22 at the very tail end of the book. See how fast we can go all the way through the book from chapter 1 to chapter 22, just like that. And in chapter 22, these things are repeated again. Look at verse 6, for example. The angel said to me, these words are trustworthy and true. The Lord, the God of the spirits of the prophets, sent his angel to show his servants the things that must soon take place. This isn't something that's going to just waiting for a fulfillment down at the end of time. These are things that are going to take place now. The very next verse, verse 7, behold, I am coming soon. And blessed is he who keeps the words of the prophecy in this book. Skip on down to chapter 22, verse 10. He told me, do not seal up the words of the prophecy of this book because the time is near. Ooh, let me do a quick aside right here. And you're going to hear this again. So I want to take a look at... I want you to remember what John is told here about do not seal up the words of this prophecy here in verse 10. At the end of the book of Daniel, let me just read this to you. At the end of the book of Daniel, Daniel has gotten some very puzzling visions in Daniel 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. And those visions relate to some things that are going to happen with the Israel, with the Jews after they come back out of captivity, and those things are going to take place over about a 300-year period of time. Well, a 400-year period of time. But at the end of the book of Daniel, it says, chapter 12, verse 8, I heard, but I did not understand, so I asked my Lord, what will the outcome of all this be? Daniel is speaking to an angel. Okay. He replied, go your way, Daniel, because the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Okay? The words are sealed. Many will be purified, made spotless, and refined, but the wicked will continue to be wicked. None of the wicked will understand, but those who are wise will understand. So this is sealed, and it takes about 400 years for it to be fulfilled. Here, John is told, do not seal it up, because the time is near. Okay? So, there doesn't seem to be any good reason for us to assume that if 400 years was a long time and Daniel should seal that up, that for John, more than 2,000 years or 2,000 years is not long enough to keep it sealed. But everybody needs to know this. I mean, it doesn't make sense, okay? So we want to keep in mind that these things have immediate relevance for the Christians who are hearing it right then. Skip on down to verse 12, chapter 22, verse 12. Behold, I'm coming soon. My reward is with me. I'll give to everyone according to what he has done. Verse 20, same chapter. He who testifies to these things says, yes, I'm coming soon. Amen. Come, Lord Jesus. There's a lot of repetition there. And the repetition is there for a reason. Because God is making a point. This is going to take place quickly. And this book has relevance for the Christians who hear it then. This isn't something that's going to be locked up and sealed for a long time. Okay, and some of that's going to come more clear as we work our way through the book. There are three pretty common approaches to attacking Revelation. There are other more obscure ways of approaching the book, but there are three primary ways of approaching it. And when you kind of survey across the literature, there's a tremendous amount of literature, by the way. When I was getting out of, this would probably be like 1997, when I was getting out of Harding Grad School, Dr. W.B. West was the founding dean of Harding Grad School, a man of advanced years and just a tremendous scholar, but he was also a man of a staggering library. I've never seen a private library with so many thousands and thousands of books. And those were just the ones that you could see in his house because he had outbuildings, he had sheds in the backyard that were crammed full, and he had historic places in town crammed full of books. It was kind of a rite of passage for us, for students, to have to move books for W.B. West. Everybody had to do it, and we got roped into it one day. Anyway, went over to his house, and in his bedroom, and his bedroom was huge, folks. The master bedroom in their house was probably half the size of our foyer. Just this huge room. Had a bookcase running right down the center of it. You had to walk around the bookcase to get to the bed. He had the bookcase, floor to ceiling, full of books. He had bookshelves like this high that went around three walls of the room. They were all crammed full. He had things piled on the floor, just stacks of books on the floor, stacks of books on the nightstand. It was like dying and going to heaven. Very much like going to heaven, because every book in his bedroom, every single book in his bedroom was on the book of Revelation. He was going to write a commentary on Revelation, thought he ought to survey the literature. Without exaggeration, folks, I would guess 2,000 books in his bedroom on Revelation. And it's just staggering the amount of material that has been written. But basically, all of this falls into three general categories. One general category is that people take the book as primarily about the future and the coming of Jesus. And so you hear things about the rapture and tribulation and the Antichrist. How many of you have heard of the Left Behind series? Okay, all of that is bound up in that approach to Revelation. That there's going to be some terrible time out there and there'll be one world government. And there are all kinds of different details about that. But anyway, this is kind of the popular view, and boy, every little flare-up that happens in the Middle East, and there's another book that's published, you know, this is it, folks, you know, get ready, here they come. There was an awful lot of silliness about the governments in China and Russia also. So the big problem with that, well, there are several big problems. One big problem with that is that approach would have absolutely nothing to say to the earliest hearers. That it would not be anything that they would be interested in. How excited would you be to know about some giant war that would happen mega centuries in your future? Probably wouldn't bother you very much. You're not going to get terribly agitated about it, particularly if you happen to be persecuted right now, which was the situation of the earliest Christians. A second approach is to consider the book as kind of an unfolding of history from the establishment of the church to Christ's return. And again, this isn't a view that persuades very many serious students of the book. But it has at different times been a very popular view, and so you'll find books that talk about the fact that this is an unfolding of world history. Especially, they zero in on the Roman Catholic Church and decide that that's the source of all the big problems. So you get the devil and the first beast and the second beast, and all that has to do with the Roman Catholic Church and the rise of the popes and political things that are going on in Europe and even in the New World later. And again, it really doesn't have anything to say to the earliest Christians. And this approach is always reinterpreted. If you got one of these guys from 200 years ago and read his stuff, he would unfold everything as it's going to happen by the end of whatever century he's in. Because that would be the sum total of all world history would have been encompassed in the book of Revelation. Well, you come 200 years later and get a hold of a guy who has taken this approach, and he does the same thing, only he says this guy's all wrong, and the history, boy, it goes right here, you know, this is all ending right now. So it's continually reinterpreted, and it really does seem to be just kind of a biased, anti-Catholic approach. It's not very persuasive at all. I don't think it's going to convince anybody. The third approach is the one that is traditional, and when I say traditional, I mean, you know, 1,800 years old, and seems to be truest to the Scriptures, and that is that the book deals primarily with the persecution of early Christians by the Roman Empire and then the judgment of God on the Roman Empire, with a very brief description at the end of the book concerning the events about Christ's return. This is how the book was understood by its earliest interpreters. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're right, but it sure demands that we pay attention to what they say. You have to figure, if John wrote this and gave it to the church, then the people who read it first understood it best. Because they always could have gone back to John and said, hey, what is this? But we assume that they understood it best. then they would have handed it on to the generation after them and explained it also if there were any explanation necessary. Remember, this is supposed to be understood instantly, not really require any explanation. And so on, and on down the way. So the earliest understanding of the book recommends itself to us. We need to pay attention to it. They're not necessarily right, but it demands that we pay attention and listen to what they have to say. The vast majority of serious Bible students throughout the centuries have always understood the book in this way. The scholarly literature, all those couple of thousand books that W.B. West had in his bedroom there, I would guess, just at a guess, I would say something like 80% would take this approach, and the other 20% would be scattergunned across a zillion other approaches, including the futurist idea. Okay, there are excellent reasons for approaching the book from this viewpoint. We're going to talk about those more in depth next time, actually. We're just kind of doing an introduction here right now. And they will become even more and more clear as we move through the study. So the book, the approach that seems most reasonable and truest to the Scriptures, to me, certainly seems to indicate that the book is written to persecuted Christians, and it's a message of comfort to them and a message of judgment on the Roman Empire for their persecution of Christians. Okay. The book is written by the Apostle John while he was in exile on the island of Patmos. You may have heard some sermons or sermon illustrations where people talk about John on Patmos, able to look across and see the coastline over there and see the city of Ephesus. And he would, you know, be in great emotional torment because he could see. That's actually not true. You can't see Ephesus from Patmos. I'm not even sure that on a clear day you can see the coast. It's about 14 miles away, and if memory serves me, the horizon at sea is generally 12 miles. But even if you could see the coast, Ephesus wasn't on the coast. It was inland about 2 miles. You had to sail up a river to get there. So you have to agree that John was probably in some emotional torment about being that close to his church at Ephesus where he had labored for so long and still not able to get there. He was in exile on Patmos. Probably around the year 92. I'm not going to quibble. You want to go a couple of years either way? I'm not going to argue with that. This is the earliest tradition of authorship. Stems from the 2nd century. The first time that it's mentioned is by a writer named Irenaeus in the 2nd century, and he makes it plain that he's talking about the Apostle John who received this revelation. And the view really wasn't called into question. The idea that John was the author wasn't really called into question until the 4th century, and the idea of some different John was given. We don't know any of the details about that, but it would have been some representative of the Roman government, because they were the only ones who had power to do that, particularly in a place like Ephesus, which was a big, thriving commercial center. The Romans would have been firmly in control there, but we don't have any historical information about the names of any Roman officials that might have done that, or how long that might have lasted, because the tradition has it that John ended his life in Ephesus. So at some point his exile would have terminated, probably on the death of a Caesar, and would have brought him back to Ephesus. And if somebody just pulled a gun on me and said, make a guess, I would guess that with the death of Emperor Titus, that John would have been allowed to go back to Ephesus. And then, you know, Domitian reigned until... '98. I think that's right. I think it was 98. Okay, I haven't given you an opportunity at all. Any other comments or questions? Anything you'd like to toss out? Yes, sir. Okay, the idea of coming soon.
Chapter 1, verse 1.
Yes, sir.
Okay, does that have reference to coming soon, and chapter 22 have reference to coming of the Savior?
The question is, does the coming soon, especially in chapter 22, I mean, it's mentioned as early as chapter 1, verse 1, but you get down to chapter 22, does it mean that Christ is coming soon? I don't think that that is the sense that Jesus intends that to be heard. I think Jesus intends it to be heard as a coming in judgment on the Roman Empire. These things are going to take place soon. This is not just going to roll on forever and ever. God has an ending in mind for this. Now, if someone wants to look at chapter 22 and say that probably has to do with the coming of Christ at the end, then I'm not prepared to make a sharp argument with that, because that is the subject that has been under discussion in chapter 20, end of chapter 20, chapter 21, and chapter 22. But I think what Jesus is trying to convey to the earliest Christians especially is that his judgment is sure and it is soon. Okay. And one of the things that I would like to say about all of this, I'm going to give you this approach to Revelation. I think every serious Bible student is going to have to keep an open mind on this. We need to be willing to call into question our presuppositions and think about this. Everything is up for study, right? We have nothing to fear from a search for the truth. We'll always be willing to study the Scriptures in any regard. Any subject you want to study about, we'll study that, no problem. Because our desire is to know and to do the truth. So, if I'm proven to be wrong in something, it's not going to bother me that I was wrong. It'll bother me if I'm not doing what is right. Okay? I'm sorry. Ask me that question again, please. Could it mean the end of the Christian persecution because of the fall of Rome? You put me on the spot here, and you're asking me for a determination. I think not, and I'll tell you why not. The fall of Rome would not end Christian persecution. Christian persecution continues even to this day, and so I think it would stop the persecution by Rome, but I don't think it would mean the end of all Christian persecution, because that certainly has not been the case. Okay, we've got just a few minutes. Let's zoom through some rules about apocalyptic literature and just think about some of the reasons why this is a little bit difficult for us, and we haven't really encountered this kind of literature. Apocalyptic literature, I've already talked about, every kind of literature has its particular rules to follow, and we don't get too excited about that. Apocalyptic literature is a different kind of literature, so we need to understand its rules and follow this. This was very popular during the age of about 200 BC to 100 AD. Now, there were other apocalyptic writings before that, and there were other apocalyptic writings after that, but boy, its heyday was really in that 300-year period. There were a lot of apocalypses written. They're not inspired writings, but they go by the same kinds of rules, okay? Just like there were a lot of letters that were written during that time. They weren't inspired letters like the ones from Paul and Peter. So there were a lot of apocalyptic writings, and consequently the scholars can lay these out and see these patterns develop, and they can see what's taking place here and why these things work the way they do. Okay, number one, first thing to remember is apocalyptic literature comes out of some kind of critical situation in history. Bad times are happening. Bad days are going on. And so this kind of writing is called forth out of this difficult situation. Of course, the situation in Revelation is the Christians are being persecuted, grotesquely persecuted. Number two, literature is mostly expressed in visions. Angels figure really prominently, or perhaps some other messengers from God in these non-inspired apocalypses. We get angels in Revelation. Apocalyptic typically has a strong predictive element. The visions are not confined to right now, but often have to do with a glorious future out there. So in spite of the fact things are going badly now, God has a plan, things are going to work out, it's going to be okay in the end. Okay? And number four, it relies very heavily on symbols and especially numbers. We're going to talk more about this. Here are just some basic, I didn't want to just give you a chart of what the numbers mean, but these ideas are generally conveyed by the numbers. Number one stands for unity, two for strength. You got a helper there. Number three stands for God, typically. You have the Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. It's amazing how many threes are involved with God. The number four stands for the earth. You've got four winds. You've got four corners of the earth. We talk about the four points of the compass. There's no particular reason for that, except it's just ancient tradition. We talk about four being involved with the earth. Six, the number six stands for evil. And the reason the number six stands for evil is because the number seven stands for perfection. God in harmony with the world. Four and three, the world and God joined together. Seven is the perfect number. Everything is great. Six just misses. So six is the number for evil, which will help us when we get over to that 666 thing, because what that is like the highest of the highest of the high evil. I mean, it's bad. It's really, really bad. It doesn't get any worse than that. That's what that number is supposed to convey. It's really bad. The number 10 stands for human perfection because you got 10 fingers, you got 10 toes, and in the ancient world, not a lot of people got to adulthood with 10 fingers and 10 toes. You know, little things happen. You know, you can get one cut off from time to time. And, so, 10 is the number for human perfection. 12 is the number for perfect accord between God and man. You got 4, there's the world. 3, there's God. Multiply them together, you got the number 12. And think about how often the number 12 is associated with God's working. You had 12 tribes of Israel, you got 12 apostles, and you got a lot of 12s out there. The number 1,000 is for perfect, completeless. Multiples of 10 are important, too. So 10 is complete, complete, complete. You know, the more multiples you get, the more complete and whole everything is. A special case for the number 3.5, half of 7. It's on its way to perfection, hadn't got there yet. It's the number for incompleteness, 3.5. You didn't know that, did you? 3.5. See, 3 stands for God. 3.5 is just not there. It's incomplete.
Okay,
Matthew 24, talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and then the subsequent return of Jesus at the very end. And that stuff is also echoed in the companion chapters, Mark 13 and Luke 21. And I'll let you finish this up on your own. The bottom line on all of this is the persecuted Christians are supposed to understand, we win. It looks bad now, but don't worry about it. God has the situation well in hand, and we win. That's the message of Revelation, okay? It's not that hard. Don't get scared of it. You're going to be very confident that you understand it well. All right? Thanks for your attention. I'll see you here next Sunday, Lord willing.